Great. Okay.
Pete Griffin here.
Well, I want to welcome everybody to our call. I'm Tricia Griffin Carty. I'm chair of the Stories and Organization SIG, part of National Storytelling Network. And this is our February 2018 Story Lab. And we are about to hear from our speaker, Julie Fitzpatrick Rafferty, who's going to talk to us a bit about disruptive storytelling. So I'm just going to stop here for a moment and, again, just welcome all the callers that we have on the line. We have a nice representation from really across the country and to California, back to Boston, somewhere in Utah, Colorado. And, you know, our format tonight is that we're going to hear from Julie, who's going to speak with us for a bit, and we can certainly, you know, at some point ask questions. She'll let us know how she'd like to handle that. And then we'll also be, you know, kind of jumping in with our own thoughts, you know, on this very interesting topic. So to begin, I want to say that it's a pleasure as Tricia Griffin Carty to welcome Julie Fitzpatrick Rafferty. I think we should have been doing this in March in Boston, Julie.
Yeah, right.
So I sort of looked at your name and mine. So.
Yeah, right.
March is
we
St.
Like
Patrick's
three-part names.
That we do. And March is St. Patrick's month.
Right.
So
right,
we're just
right.
About oh. There. And I saw, Julie, I met you just, I don't know, a few weeks ago. You were doing a presentation for a group here in Boston called the Association for Fundraising Professionals. And it was a really interesting segment. You were doing it with a colleague who's also a client, I guess, and you were talking about this thing called disruptive storytelling. So I was delighted that you are were interested in sharing it with our group tonight. And as I said, they're a group that's dedicated to learning, so I'm sure there'll be some interesting comments. And just before I hand it over to you, Julie, I will ask if you're on the call, if you are in a noisy area or whatever, if you could mute your line, which would be *6, and then just remember to unmute, you know, to ask a question or make a comment. And I think that's about it for the housekeeping items. So, Julie.
Yes.
So where would you like to start with disruptive storytelling?
Well, I think what I'll start with is how I came to give a presentation or two mm-hmm. or three on disruptive storytelling, which was, as you, Tricia mentioned, I'm with an organization called the Association of Fundraising Professionals, and on their board here for the Massachusetts affiliate, and somebody sent me an email one day and said, you know, we need somebody to do a presentation. We do monthly presentations. Could you do one in disruptive storytelling? And, you know, I paused for a second, and I was like, yeah, sure, why not? And, you know, sent the email off and then said, gee, I wonder what disruptive storytelling is. And so that sent me on a little bit of the usual sort of Google search. And as soon as I found a description of what it was, I said, oh, I see disruptive storytelling all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think the group of students who are on the call from Weber State, I think, will come to appreciate this in particular because they're business students. But let me just back up a little bit, and I want to encourage people to ask questions at any point. I like to be interrupted. But let me just, for folks who are on the call who are not storytelling aficionados, tell just for a second what is the importance of storytelling overall before I tell what disruptive storytelling is per se. And the reason telling stories is important if you work in marketing or PR, communications, or fundraising, is because when you tell people a group of facts, you make a persuasive, logical argument, that engages a few parts of the other person's brain, but not in the same way that storytelling does, that with combined with imagery and visuals and a good story, engages multiple parts of the brain and enables people not only to better remember what you said, but then to repeat it to others. And of course, that's from a, you know, from a for-profit business perspective, that ability to have people tell the story to their friends, the word of mouth kinds of thing. And it, mm-hmm. it is part of what's really important in terms of how you actually sell products and services. So what is disruptive storytelling? I think most of us are pretty familiar with what I would characterize as the hero narrative, which so many films and books are written using, which is, you know, the hero maybe is sort of reluctant and he's on a journey or she's on a journey and they encounter some kind of a problem that they must overcome and they are questioning and then they have some great epiphany in the process of overcoming that journey and then overcoming that obstacle and solving that problem, and then they go on. I mean, you can think of this in terms of what happens in Star Wars or what happens in the new Black Panther movie. We can think of lots of examples of what is called, you know, a hero narrative. Well, disruptive storytelling, the focus isn't so much on the journey of the hero or the individual. The focus is much more on your audience. And it has really four components to us. And I want to thank a gentleman by the name of Ryan Key, who wrote about this on a website called popvideo.com a few months ago, for really synthesizing what disruptive storytelling is. And the way you tell a disruptive story is you tell a story of how things are traditionally. That's the first example. And then you empathize with the frustrations of your audience. You explain about how the old way of doing things is no good, and then you suggest a new way of doing things. Now, I know that those four points are probably pretty hard to imagine in the abstract, so I'm going to give you an example that's very easy for you to figure out. Anybody or everybody on the call has probably used either Airbnb or Uber in their lives. And in the case of Airbnb, you know, the message that comes across is, you know, when you go and you travel, don't you want to have an authentic experience? Don't you hate going into a hotel that's like a hotel you stayed in every place else? And so if you were going to tell the story of disruption of Airbnb, it's telling the story of how things are traditionally, that you go into a hotel and you open the door to the room and the room looks like a room you've been in every time. And you empathize with the frustrations of the audience because they aren't getting that true, authentic experience of what it's like to live in the particular area that they're visiting. And you explain why this old way of doing things is no good. You may, in fact, mention the legacy products by name, and then you suggest a new way of doing things, which in the case of Airbnb is, you know, staying in a room with people, in a house with people who are live in the area that you're visiting, who are in a neighborhood, so you can go to the local restaurants and the local movie theater, et cetera, and have an authentic experience. And so that's kind of the way Airbnb, when it first came out, positioned itself as a disruptor. It truly has disrupted, you know, the hotel and the vacationing and even the business travel industry. But the story that underlies a lot of the advertising, et cetera, that you see is this kind of disruptive storytelling. I'll give another example of that, which may be for those of us who watch TV perhaps more than we should. There's an ad out there for Samsung phones, and it's only a minute long because it's an ad. And it shows a young man getting his first iPhone in 2007. The date kind of flashes up on the screen, and he's standing in line, and he excitedly gets his first iPhone, and he opens it, and he's so pleased. And then the screen comes up to the year flashes up 2013, and he sees that his friend, you're left with the impression it's probably his girlfriend, and she's standing there with her big screen, much bigger screen Samsung phone. And he kind of looks at that and says something like, oh, big screen. And then you cut, and again, and it's 2015. And there he is standing to get his next iPhone, only this time it's raining. And he's surrounded by a whole long line of people all standing in line to get a phone, but it's pouring rain. And then the screen flashes up again, and it's 2016. And he and the girl are playing, fooling around on a dock, on a lake, and they both fall in. Her phone still works. His, he has to take and drop into a bag of rice and hopes that the rice will dry out his phone so it'll work again. And then that takes us to the final scene where he is now not standing in line. He is standing in his home, his room, and he takes his iPhone and he drops it in a drawer and closes it. And he has a Samsung phone in his hand and he writes with the stylus, "Guess what I got?" And that's the story in a nutshell of disruptive storytelling. Tells the story of how things were traditionally, how you were excited back in the early years to get an iPhone, the frustrations that came over the years of standing in line, of having the smaller screen, of having your phone fall in the water and it doesn't work. And in this case, they actually name the legacy product by hand, by name, iPhone, compared to Samsung. And then by the end, it's suggesting a new way of doing things, which in this case is the guy breaks with iPhone and now uses a Samsung. So that's basically how what I characterize as sort of the narrative arc of disruptive storytelling. Another example that one might think of is Netflix. Those of us who are old enough to remember the Blockbuster Video and some of the other video stores, the way Netflix originally positioned itself is, you know, rent all the DV movies you want, no late fees. So it focuses on, you know, what were the frustrations of going to Blockbuster? And, you know, their ads would show the person going to Blockbuster to pick up a video and the particular video he or she wanted was all out. Or getting, you know, a late fee. And then, of course, Netflix, they solved all of these problems by you just order it in the mail and it comes back in the day. Before streaming, comes in a little red envelope. You can order as many as you want. There are no late fees. You just go to the mailbox and drop it in the mail, and miraculously the next day, the next thing you want that's on your list shows up at your door. Uber, the same way, the story of disruption. Headline in an early Uber ad is, "With Uber, say goodbye to missed flights," and it shows a picture of a man running crazily to get to his flight. And why is that? Because, you know, the taxi cab that he called at 5 a.m., he had no idea whether it was actually going to show up in time for his 6 a.m. flight or not. But with Uber, you know where the car is, when it's going to arrive, and how you're going to get to the airport, and so your anxiety is relieved. So all of these are examples of disruptive organizations having created what one might consider an entirely new and different storytelling format. Airbnb. Their tagline, which is disruptive storytelling in seven words, book rooms with locals rather than hotels.
Interesting.
Now, if you think about how a nonprofit might use this in the world that I live in, which is related to nonprofit communications and fundraising, probably, you know, the March of Dimes isn't going to say they're better than the American Cancer Society. UC Berkeley isn't going to say that they're better than Stanford. Well, they probably will. How a nonprofit may do this disruptive storytelling may be slightly different than the way a for-profit would do it. But the angle and the narrative arc would be quite similar. Unfortunately, the way nonprofits and many for-profits tell their story it really can be pretty boring. They start with, you know, "Hi, you know, we're the local diabetes center. We help people with diabetes no matter what their age is." They talk about what they do, who they help, how long their organization has been in existence. They maybe list some major accomplishments, but they're probably like bullet points rather than stories about people and how those accomplishments occurred. They may talk about, you know, in a fundraising context, you know, what they want to do next and how they will help people and how donors can help. And you'll see in your average, you know, fundraising solicitation, stories of people who have been helped, but it's almost like it's there as an afterthought or as window dressing. And nonprofits seldom put themselves or the people in the narrative of the organization in the way that, you know, the storytelling around a place like Airbnb or a company like Netflix does. And so part of what I was doing in the presentation that Tricia saw was to encourage the other nonprofits, communications and fundraisers in the office, I mean in the meeting, to think about how they can tell a story of disruption. Again, a story that tells the story of how things are traditionally, empathizes with the frustrations of the audience for the old way of doing things, explains why the old way of doing things is no good, and then suggests a new way of doing things. And so what I'd like to put out to the group who's on the phone call tonight is a little bit of the exercise that we did in the presentation that I did for the fundraisers, and it was around an organization called Pine Street Inn, who here in Boston runs the largest homeless shelter, but actually right now they spend more of their money and resources on providing housing for formerly homeless people than they actually spend on the homeless shelter, the very large homeless shelter that they run. And part of what they are trying to do in their fundraising activity is to get people to think of them more for housing for formerly homeless people than to think of them as a homeless shelter that solves the problem of homeless people for a night. And so their programs are things like rapid rehousing, where when someone becomes homeless, perhaps because they've lost a job or had an illness, they provide the services to help them become self-sustaining and to ultimately find a home. And part of the reason that they do this is because 90 to 95% of the people who go from homelessness to having a home remain housed. And so that housing really is the solution to homelessness. So the organization is trying to raise money to expand its rapid rehousing program and to build an extra 200 units of housing for the severely mentally ill and homeless so that there will be almost no or very few homeless people on Boston streets. So now I'm going to throw things. That's my presentation. It's not overly long.
Okay.
I'm going to throw
I'm going to ask you, Julie. This is Tricia.
Go ahead.
I'm going to ask you, why don't we stop here for a minute, because there's so many interesting things that you've mentioned. And I'm wondering, maybe we could open up the lines now for a few questions and
yeah,
then go
that
to
was
the
what
activity.
I was going
to
suggest. Mm-hmm.
Great, great. Okay, so everybody on the line, would you please unmute? And if you have questions for Julie. And while we're doing that, I'm going to give a little bit of Julie's background. She's coming to you tonight talking about disruptive fundraising, but disruptive storytelling. She's had more than 20 years of fundraising, media relations, and marketing communications experience. And she has been the Associate Vice Dean for Communications at the Harvard School of Public Health and also the Director of Communications at the Harvard-affiliated Joslin Diabetes Center. So she has certainly that background in strategic marketing communications and getting your message across. And this is part of that. So I just wanted to give a little bit more about where she comes from. So I'm opening up the line, and who has a question for our speaker?
Julie, this is Kristen Link, and I live in Silicon Valley, where most of your stories came from. Thank you for that.
Yes, thank you.
but I'm originally from the Boston area, so I'm feeling connected to many people right now. Just a question, and I find oftentimes when I'm working with Silicon Valley startups, generally in the very early stage of starting up, pre-product, pre-investment, so forth, there's a real struggle with them realizing that they don't have to be
the quote here of the story, but that their product is or their company is.
Right.
How have you helped nonprofits in that area to help them identify who's the main character in the story and the fact that it doesn't have to be a human? I struggle with that a lot.
Interesting question, because in the fundraising realm,
yeah,
we believe people give to people.
Yes.
So to a certain extent, we're always looking, you know, because it isn't a transaction in the same way as, you know, I buy a room for a night or a ride in somebody's car.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to think about that for a minute. it's also a little abstract. I think at the end of the day, let's go through the samples that we talked about. Netflix, the mm-hmm. idea of solving a problem is the hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was replacing getting your car and going to Blockbuster with mm-hmm. a little red envelope at least, that showed up in your so if you think about the early ads that existed for Netflix, those little red envelopes were a huge marketing thing. And,
mm-hmm.
and even, you know, so if you think about what the hero or the focus was, it was the little red envelope. If you think about iPhones
mm.
and the amount to which Steve Jobs and the folks at Apple focused on the design of this thing people didn't know they needed until they got one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the phone is the hero.
Right.
And of
right.
course, even in the story I told about the Samsung ad, the cooler phone is the hero.
you know,
the bigger with the stylus, the way you can write the little notes and send them. So, I mean, I think, in fact, in many cases, these other companies have succeeded. Airbnb, it's a little harder to say to visualize what the thing is, other than maybe in that case the hero is the experience.
Yeah, I think
and so in that sense it's being in the cool neighborhood and the cool house rather than the sanitized Hilton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I mean I think that's what I would say.
Yeah, that helps. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would just say maybe that that second point that Julie made about empathizing with the frustrations of your audience, I think that just translates itself to every group. So I'm just having to think of that bullet.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Thinking about what problem your product solves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean,
I
obviously iPhone didn't solve.
Here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, Tom?
So this is Tom in Cincinnati, and I was thinking that in all those instances, really, I don't see the product as the hero. It's the person who's savvy enough to use the product is the hero. It's because of the product that they become the hero. And then the problem is that they don't have the product. And then
mm-hmm.
once they
so
have
they can't
the
be
product,
the hero.
Yeah, so they can be the hero. And it's just, you know, as we were just hearing Julie say, that, you know, it's that situation without the product that causes them to need the product, which ultimately makes them the hero because they get the product.
Hmm. Mm.
That's an interesting
very
question.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so in some ways, working with a startup and sort of telling them several of these stories of, you know, Silicon Valley success stories, and then going
mm-hmm.
back and saying, you know, okay, think of it a couple different ways. What problem is your product solving?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
So you can share the empathy, and then saying, mm-hmm. is the product the hero? You know, do we want to make, is there some feature about it that we want to make cool and memorable so it becomes the star of the narrative? Or is
mm-hmm.
it the person that we want to tell the story of and how they become the star of the narrative?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you watch those the Samsung ad, the guy is the focus. He is the main. He shares the focus with the phone.
Yeah.
In the narrative.
Okay. Hmm. Yeah, he really does.
That's a great ad. If anyone hasn't seen it, it'd be great to Google it because it, mm-hmm. it is. It tells such a story. Julie, you did that so beautifully describing it. So how about other questions for our speaker?
Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Cynthia. Well, I'll toss one in here, Julie. I'm really thinking about this. You know, we've got the traditional ways of doing things, and it's really going to suggest a new way of doing things. And this could be for all of us on the call. I'm just thinking about when and how an organization gets to the point when they're ready to toss aside the old way of doing things, mm-hmm. which can be hard to let go of, because we're going to tell a story of how things are traditionally, explain why the old way of doing things is not working anymore, and then move to a new. It just seems to me as though it makes perfect sense, you know, when you think about it, but I could probably see some resistance along the way there, especially if it gets into areas like maybe changing a logo or a brand or part of a brand. So I guess maybe you could speak to your experience in working with Pine Street, you know, because they are really looking at themselves differently. Was it a series of things, or was it, you know, something that was over time, you know, that they began to embrace this idea? Because I forget how old Pine Street is, but it's been around.
It's going to be 50 years old next year.
50 years old. Mm. It's so well known in the mm-hmm. Boston area, the Pine Street Inn. Everybody knows mm-hmm. the Pine Street Inn. So could you talk a little bit about that? Maybe had they made that decision before you started working with them, or did you help them get there, or what?
Well, I don't know that they've gotten – what I see when I came in as a consultant was that they are morphing from being something that everybody thinks of as a homeless shelter. Like back in the early days when they started, the precursor to them was restaurants. They tell a very interesting story about one of their supporters who ran a restaurant who used to let the homeless people sleep in the back of the restaurant at night. He'd give them leftover food and let them sleep in the restaurant in the back of the night. And then you go from that to fast forward to, you know, the 80s of having, you know, large homeless shelter and solving a problem for a night. And then came late 80s, beginning of the 90s, realizing that, you know, housing is expensive, but that, you know, helping and that, you know, you've got a large population of folks, many of whom are mentally ill, who are on the street. And so it's not just a matter of putting them, you know, giving them first and last month's rent and putting them in a house or an apartment. It's creating housing that is supported. So a lot of the 40-plus houses with multiple units in it that they provide have, you know, social workers and other folks on staff to help people, you know, move from a shelter situation or the street to living in a room in a supported setting, in a home, in a neighborhood, to then in some cases then subsequently being able to find, you know, independent housing, et cetera. And in other cases, it's people who have just had a rough patch in life. And rather than having them get into being, you know, just being in this mindset of I've got to find a place to sleep at night and moving beyond that to, well, no, we need to help you start saving some money for a first and last month's rent so that you can stop sleeping here and be sleeping in a real home. And so that's been an evolution within the organization. And so how you convey that evolution within the organization to the broader world who thinks more in terms of, oh, you're a shelter. You're this place where the people go at night when they don't have any place else to sleep. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's still part of the part of the process, and it's a disruption to people's concept of how you work with homeless people. And so it's still a work in progress. I guess that's what I would say.
Most things are, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So let me go back to the group. I'm wondering if anybody in the audience on the call has had an example maybe, or either a question for Julie or maybe an example that they've either experienced or maybe they're wondering about or that they've seen that they would say, aha, I wonder now if that was a bit of disruptive storytelling, you know, in terms of what you've observed. So I'm going to throw that out to the group. And what if we see what we've got?
We've got silence.
We've got breathing. Somebody take a pulse. I told Julie it was a very thoughtful group, and I said there will be silence.
I have a question.
Yes.
Julie, so this is Tom again. And I'm wondering about, like, spin that politicians put on different emphasis. Like, if they want to take down a union and call it the Jobs and Family Act, and they, in a sense, so much of spin is creating a narrative that emphasizes a positive that may be embedded in what they're trying to do, but there are certainly some other consequences that go with it. Is that disruptive storytelling as well?
Could be, and I'm not going to, you know, take on politics one way or the other. I mean, I think that's, you know, been called framing.
As people say things like, you know, we have to get ahead with the optics here.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a book that people have told me I should read, but I've never read, that's called Don't Think of an Elephant, that is about... you know, giving a different frame to something. And certainly using disruptive storytelling is a way to have people think about an old idea in a new way could also, you know, be possible. And, you know, I'd probably like to get a little bit away from politics and think about, you know, how do you make a refrigerator or a car, you know, or let's take driverless cars, for example. How would you make, you know, driverless cars could, you know, either way you want to frame it, is going to be a disruption. It could be a disruption for problematic way, which is that it will leave a lot of people who now work in the trucking industry or Uber drivers out of work. But it can also be from a positive perspective and framing it as our population ages. It, one day, you know, kids will never have to take the keys away from mom or dad because everybody will have driverless cars, and so you'll be able to drive independently when you're 95. You know, so, I mean, I think in that sense, you can take any thought or idea, and depending on whether you're for it or against it, you can make it sound like either a positive or a negative disruption. It just takes some thinking. And it takes some getting in the shoes of the people you're trying to persuade. And I think part of why we brought disruptive storytelling as an idea to nonprofits is because the people who donate hear this story of disruption so much in their for-profit business lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so they're looking for that same kind of feeling when they give.
I was wondering if, like, disruptive storytelling is like one up on innovations storytelling. It's like such an innovation that it's going to disrupt the whole field because it's a game changer.
Right. That sounds so much cooler.
It's a disruptive
disruptive is, and in fact, this is an issue that gets talked about in fundraising groups is, you know, I work at a major university in the medical center, and we have a lot of amazing innovations, but now, you know, when our donors come in, they're saying, you know, well, what are you doing that's going to be truly disruptive? And they haven't really thought about that, but if they did, they'd have an answer, you know, and they'd start with that. So I think you're absolutely right that innovation and disruption are close cousins.
Mm-hmm. Well, the innovation can cause the disruption.
Right.
I mean, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of those two words going together, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Bill White, who is on the phone, I think, you know, he was part of Kodak. And so the whole...
I'm from Rochester, New York, so I know the tale.
Yeah. So, I mean, digital photos certainly disrupted the photo industry.
Mm-hmm. They did.
Oh, Polaroid here in Boston. Yeah.
Right. Right. That's right. And each of those companies, both in terms of their products, I mean, mostly in terms of their products, but also in terms of their messaging, they kind of lost the boat. There probably was a way, at least for a while, that they could have, you know, kept going if they had reinvented themselves and said, you know, higher quality photos. You know, when you think about the early iPhones, photo quality wasn't that good. Kodak could have, you know, hung on by empathizing with the fact that the photos aren't very good, or empathizing with the fact that you have thousands of photos and yet you don't know where any of them are. The only way, you know, and in fact they probably could have a resurgence in terms of printing paper, not film, by simply saying it's time you started to print some of your photos, because our entire way of living is going to disappear because there isn't anything tactile for anybody to find. And that would be a disruption in reverse.
Disruption in reverse. No, this is so interesting to think of it that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that there's the question about that people don't handwrite letters anymore. And yet there's, you know, millions and millions and billions and billions of emails, but they aren't anywhere except electronically. And as we know from, you know, 8-track players and VCRs, as the machines capable of playing electronic things disappear.
We're having a disruption now.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to ask whoever is being the disruptor, consciously or unconsciously, to please hit mute, hit whatever it is, starts.
Right.
That was not a plant. That wasn't intended to happen. So.
So that was Geraldine, who didn't know she was on a really noisy floor.
Oh, Geraldine, welcome, Geraldine.
Thought she could just walk and talk at the same time, but apparently I can't.
But I want to pick up on something here. I think that's the discussion that just went on, if you think about it, about Kodak and the pictures, and how many of us sit around the table at dinner or Thanksgiving or Christmas and we pass our phone around. I know my family does, to see their vacation photos, because we never quite get to do it the other way, or we just pass the phone around. And so maybe it's that full cycle going back, and with the handwriting. There are beautiful stationery stores. You can get some beautiful stationery online now, you know, to handwrite, you know, your notes. So it's sort of like we go through cycles. But anyway,
well, in much the same way that people thought digital books were going to run every independent bookseller out of business. And they did. They disrupted the industry to the point at which one of the two majors, Borders, went under, and Barnes & Noble was, you know, heavily damaged by the process. But now, in fact, I think data suggests that the decline in paper book purchases has ended, and in fact it's going back up and people are buying more books than they did before, and the purchase of digital books has plateaued. You know, so I think that's a story of disruption too, you know. Disruption only goes so far.
And audiobooks are booming.
Right, that's the next thing.
Audiobooks are booming. So again, what was the frustration there? Well, you're driving in your car all the time. You can't read while you're driving. So we can give you a way to read books, to hear books by doing that.
Well, or the disruption is I'm sick of looking at a screen all day long.
Yes, that too. That's what yes, you don't. So you want to use something different.
Right.
Great conversation. Other comments?
It's Jules. Speaking of one of many on the call, witnessed the advent of the internet gaining strength. It was really interesting at the time, though. I was working down at American Express, and they were starting to use a lot of, and I'm just making this from analogy of product-driven decisions that happen. So the internet was starting to get more footing. People were starting to figure out what they're going to do it with products, et cetera, financial products. But I thought at the same time in the American Express building, there was a pen store that was doing gangbusters, these very high, elegant pens. So it was like a yin and a yang. While all this internet and online was happening, there was still like a very intimate relationship with the pen and the writing equipment that was happening. So I think it's always looking for contrast. So when we have all this technology, guess what? The storytelling is happening and taking foot. You know, so what's happening that interesting contrast in human behavior? That's it. I'm done. That's all I have of value today. Back to being quiet.
So I guess part of what we're hearing from all of this is that, you know, disruption happens in cycles. And the story of disruption, if you feel like that's what your audience needs to hear, is can be told over something that is relatively old and tried and true, just reframed in a different way. Or it can be, as one of the callers asked, you know, how do you figure out to tell the story of something that is a new product that truly will be disruptive? How do you decide what the hero is and how you'll tell the story of that hero, whether it's the product or the person who uses the product? But, you know, it's just another tool in the toolbox. If your role is as a marketer, if your role is, and it's important to be telling stories because people will remember the stories and retell them in a way that a litany of straight facts or hyperbole about how wonderful your product or service is just won't stick.
This is Kristen. Just to segue on that, if it's okay. Although I was not calling it disruptive storytelling with my clients, I now will. It's a very cool term. However, I notice that sometimes when I'm working with clients, the initial story that they try to tell is not. It's very factual, very informational. And oftentimes I really need to drill down and ask, why are you doing this in the first place? And there's a pause, and there's a funny look, and then finally they get a little more reflective and bring out the story of why they did this. Just as a quick example, I'm working with a startup, two college football players, Division I football players, recent grads, starting a business to help college students get in touch with all the resources on their campus. So busy college students now know where the homework is, what the teacher's office hours are, where groups are meeting, and so forth. And when they delivered their pitch, it was very, very informational, very flat. And I finally pulled the guy aside afterwards and looked up at this big, huge football player and looked him in the – I know, I'm trying to be nice. And I phrased it a different way, and I said, is this important to you? And I knew I was going to, you know, irritate him a little bit, but I had good intent. And he said, well, yeah, Kristen, what do you mean? I said, I didn't hear any of that in your pitch. Tell me why this is important to you. And he dove into a big story about, I was so stressed and it was so awful and I don't want any other college student to feel that stress I felt. I want to help them overcome stress. So the pitch went from a very high level, here's this app that we wrote that has these features, to I want to address college student stress. And all of a sudden, the story was a lot deeper and much more impactful, and people paid attention to that. Any parent with a college student, any recent grad could really understand, okay, this is the big problem he's trying to solve. Mm-hmm. And now I know this is a big disruption that he's trying to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it can it can take a lot of time.
It can take a lot of time. And even as you were saying that, I was thinking about a lot of parents whose kids, you know, in high school may have what they call here in Massachusetts, I don't know if they call them that, IEPs, which are, you know, because they may have a certain learning disability or another, and so they'll have certain things. And if they have a challenge specifically with executive functioning, sending them off to college is particularly fraught because you're spending all that money. And and you know the thing that they had through high school, they're just not going to have, you know, when they get to college. And so, you know, him talking about that, you know, is, you know, and how stressful it is. You know, you could you could imagine it being like a Campbell Soup commercial. If you remember those ones with the mothers and the football players, is, you know, and then the mother talking about, you know, I was really worried that my son, you know, wasn't going to keep his college football scholarship because he wasn't going to be organized enough, you know, you know, and that would be a heck of a story, you know.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So that's a great example. I'm thinking of the that a disruptive story needs to go to the right audience. As we all know, you know, the audience is everything. You know, so who's going to hear it? So somebody who doesn't have, you know, thoughts and concerns around IEPs, individual education plans, may not respond. They might respond to something else. But I keep coming back to the items you emphasized, Julie, in the workshop. Tell the story of how things are, which is that there's information all over the place. Emphasize with the frustrations of your audience, can't find things, why the old ways aren't doing that good a job, and suggest a new way.
Right.
Yeah, just that kind of thing.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, and so you can see how that product would fit very nicely into that.
Yes.
And it can be quick. You can skip a lot of those steps. You don't literally have, I mean, I think about that with the Airbnb slogan. It skipped all those steps, but said exactly what was in all of those steps in like 7 words.
In seven words, yeah. All right. So, well, we have a couple of minutes left, but we are getting to the top of the hour. It's about 6:50, I think. So I'm going to ask, just open it up again to any callers who would like to ask a question, make a comment. The floor is yours. Or the floor is mine.
Hello, my name is Arthretta Martin. This is my first time listening in on this with this particular group, and I missed some of the storytelling in the beginning, but I've listened enough to the Q&A to get an idea of all that was discussed. I teach storytelling to middle school children, and I've recently started teaching storytelling to a nonprofit organization that encourages social entrepreneurship with young people. And part of the challenge, just like what you were talking about, is people focus on facts as opposed to when they're trying to get someone to buy into their social entrepreneurial endeavors. They focus on the facts. So my experience and my honor has been to assist them in converting their experience and their facts to story. But I did not use the term disruptive. And I'm still wrestling with using the term disruptive. I decided to call in because I liked the way it was described in the email, you know, as far as social telling story and corporations and businesses, which is fine. But when you use that word disruptive, it it has different meaning to different people. And I know that it's a term of art in the advertising and marketing industry. But when you use it in, for instance, with the children that I'm working with, I'm not quite sure they're going to see that as a positive.
Right, because they're told not to disrupt.
Right. Oh, I think we're losing you there.
What does work is to help people to empathize with your endeavor, so you use a story to do that and how best to frame that using some of the same strategies and techniques that you were talking about, you know, the same story arc or a similar story arc. But that term disruptive, I guess it depends on the audience, whether
like
that's
everything.
The way to them.
Yeah, like if you're talking to middle schoolers, it might be that a word like innovation storytelling might feel more comfortable with them. I think when you get into an adult nonprofit world, the word innovation is used so often that the snooze button hits. So I think, again, you choose your words for your audience. But good point.
Yeah, but I like the idea. Actually, just saying storytelling for most of these organizations is enough to get, you know, we don't need the qualifying it. The whole concept of using stories to sell their products or goods or services is like an aha for a lot of folks.
Yeah, I would agree, because it is so much. Let me tell you these 12 reasons, fact-based, why you ought to do this. There's a video that I was watching the other day. I was sharing with a couple of clients. It's a really great video, and it's about, related to why you should give money to this particular charter school in New York City. And the voiceover, the visuals that you're watching as the voiceover is going on, visuals you're watching is a young woman who is a student at the charter school, it's a high school, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and getting ready to take the 2 trains in New York that she needs to take to go to school. And then showing her during the day or whatever, and showing all the things that she does to succeed in school. And so that's sort of going at you, and there's music sort of like, so that's tweaking your emotions. And then the voiceover is her voice speaking as she would speak, but giving the facts about, you know, there aren't enough charter schools, and this is how many students can be helped, but so many more students need to be helped, so on and so forth. And so it's triggering by using the 2 different mediums at the same time in a disruptive way, is triggering both emotions and giving you the facts simultaneously. And it's just sort of a clever way to think about how do you do that when you don't have video to help you. How can you actually do that if all you have is your words to do that?
Great example. Well, we are closing in on the top of the hour. So to keep us on time, I think that we'll get ready to close up. And I want to take a moment and thank our speaker, Julie, for really sharing with us her insights, her examples, and prompting us to really think a little differently and engage ourselves in terms of how we view this. So I thought the discussion was quite lively and interesting, as far as even the last piece about where do we use this word disruptive, you know, what does it mean, are there cycles, you know, this kind of thing, and how do you get there. So with that, I would like to thank everybody who is on the call, and in a moment I'm going to stop the recording, but before I do, anybody want to say hello, goodbye, or anybody on the line?
Just say thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you all, and a really interesting conversation.
Thank you
yes.
so much, Julie.
Thank you, Julie.
All right, let me just, and I'm going to end the recording.